And then feeling that feeling of despair and of sadness that I had let not only myself down, but my family and my kids. And then years later, after turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it, there I was standing at the archway of the 2014 Boston Marathon. And I was like, man, miracles do happen.
Hello and welcome to the Race Mob Podcast. This is episode number 69. I'm Kevin, entrepreneur, technology, and fitness nerd. And I'm joined by the head coach of Race Mob and master motivator, the incomparable Bertrand Newsom. Hey there, Race Mob crew. We're celebrating Latinx Heritage Month with some incredible guests. So stay tuned for some amazing stories over the next few weeks. But we'd be remiss to kick off the month if we didn't bring back one of our favorite episodes from this last year and one of the most popular from all of you. When Bertrand met Leo over 20 years ago, he had no idea that this unassuming handyman was dealing with a crippling back condition and a debilitating drug addiction. Nor could he imagine Leo's backstory, a former Latin rock star and the percussionist for the group Malo. At the age of 18, Leo was being whisked away via limo and private jet to famous venues like Carnegie Hall, American Bandstand, Rolling on the River, and much more. Leo's life is so fascinating that it was even documented in an ESPN Deportes feature. From the highest of highs to being so broken he could barely function. It got so bad his family staged an intervention and forced Leo into rehab. But it was here and shortly after at Skyline College where Leo began to rekindle his passion for running. A passion he almost completely threw away due to his addiction, but was now ready to embrace. Leo and his wife, Virginia, joined the Dolphins South End Running Club, and to date have logged over 17,000 miles, attended hundreds of races, become brazen streakers, qualified for Boston, and have been sober for over 16 years. But most importantly, Leo and Virginia have now become pillars of the running community, spreading their love and positive message to everyone they meet, especially those who are struggling with addiction. And they've even become running coaches, inspiring the next generation of runners. Best of all, Leo never lost his passion for music and is performing with his new band, Momotombo, and they are killing it. You're gonna love this story from the heartache, the perseverance, and the triumphs. So here we go.
Welcome to the Race Mob Podcast. And we're very fortunate today to have Mr. Leo Rosales, accomplished marathoner, Boston marathoner, that is, someone who discovered running later in life, and his story is incredibly profound. We'll take a journey through his life, through his eyes, the ups and downs of life, much like a marathon. There's always points of adversity, and we get to that emotional crossroads, whether to go, to stop, to put one foot in front of the other. And Leo's story is incredibly compelling, and he'll share with us. Leo, so fortunate to have you with us. Welcome.
Nice to see both of you again.
Welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks.
Before we even started here, we were listening to some music, some fantastic music. Tell us about this. I mean, accomplished musician, that should have been in the intro. Accomplished musician as well.
Before I got into running many, many, many years ago, I was fortunate enough to be introduced to a group called Malo back in 1971, 72. As we were growing up, we were starting to pick up instruments and everybody starting to learn how to play and everybody started getting interested in different instruments, because at that point in time, the Summer of Love was around the corner, you know, around 68, 69. So we were watching all of this unfold. And so we all started getting interested in playing music. And eventually, I developed the ability to play percussion, drums, congas, timbales. And there was a group in the Bay Area called the Malibus who were playing at this club down off of Silver Avenue and San Bruno in San Francisco. And we used to go down there, and a friend of mine, a brother, wanted to expose us to some different kind of music. Well, actually, we would go there every weekend. You know, we'd get a fake ID, you know, get in through the door, and then he would introduce us to the band members and say, hey, can these guys play a song with you? And at first they were hesitant because, you know, they had their own thing going, but eventually, because of he persuaded them, you know, please just give this guy a chance. You know, he's young, he's from the Bay Area. So they'd allow me to come up on stage and play. So I learned some tricks up there. And eventually that group went on to get a recording contract. A friend of a friend got a hold of this producer who brought in a person from Warner Brothers. They came in and saw the band and loved the band and signed them to a 5-year contract. They went on to record. And while they were in the studio, they had some personnel changes. The singer, Arcelio Garcia, who just a couple of weeks ago passed away, you know, after keeping the name Malo going for over 50 years, he gave me a call and said, "Hey, everybody likes the way you play. You know, you've come down to the club and participated." He goes, "How about coming over and auditioning with us? We got a record contract. We're getting ready to go out on the road. We got a hit single coming out on the radio." And I was, you know, intimidated by all that. So I said, "Well, I think I want to make it on my own. I got my own band. And, you know, we're going to, you know, we're writing music. We want to go." He goes, "But, you know, but we already got all that. I'm saving you a lot of work. You know, you can come into our band. We already got a contract. We're going out on the road. We got a hit single. You know, it's going to be fantastic." So I went down there, auditioned for the band, and got the gig. And from there on, all of a sudden, I was driving around hearing the Malo band on the radio stations that were famous at that time, like AM, KYA, KFRC, KDIA, KSOL, and then on FM, KSAN. But all of a sudden, I was like super popular. I was still a senior in high school at Balboa High School. And all of a sudden, I'm getting picked up in front of the school in a big old stretch Cadillac, you know, and I'm starting to get treated in a special way, you know, taking to music stores, buying instruments, you know, rehearsing every day, and then preparing to go out on the road. So I spent a year and a half with Malo out on the road, and it was an amazing, wonderful experience. We did the Last Days at the Fillmore album with Bill Graham. We played at Winterland with Tito Puente, with Black Oak Arkansas, with Black Sabbath, with all these heavy hitters 10 years after, Quicksilver, and played at Carnegie Hall. We headlined Carnegie Hall. We played Central Park. We opened up for Ike and Tina Turner at the Long Beach Arena. You know, we were being whisked off in Learjets from San Francisco to L.A., and I was only like 18 years old. All of this fame and fortune was just kind of spinning. Not out of control yet, but it was spinning pretty fast. And so that's where my music career started. Started very young. I kept staying in the music circles. And, you know, just like if you really have a desire for something special in your life and you have a dream, you got to follow the dream by following the roads that leads to it, you know, by putting yourself with the right people in the right place at the right time and making all the sacrifices of playing as much as you can, wherever you can. And eventually you make connections here and there, and it takes a little bit of time. But I managed to follow my heart and follow the dream. And I managed to hook up with Malo and had a nice career with them for, you know, a year and a half. And then, you know, life started taking its turns, and I started making choices that, you know, led me down different pathways. So I hope that conveys what my journey was in music. So I'm still playing now. You know, years later, unfortunately, under this COVID-19 semi-sheltering in place that's going on right now, we had 15 shows lined up in 2020. And unfortunately, each and every one of them got canceled due to this situation that we find ourselves in. That's my little story of my musical journey.
A little story regarding a musical journey. I mean, let's look at your life as a marathon and your love for music and the exposure you had, the life experience it had, how the trajectory it put you on. Let's look at it as a race of life, and you got to an aid station and maybe started out a little quick, you know, and needed to kind of catch your breath and kind of transition from that point. You know, Leo, young man with some very talented musician, toured the world, popular band. Then you find yourself away from the group and doing your own thing, and then kind of the life's adversities and where your pace started to change a bit and you're looking to find your rhythm.
To speak to that, how we get to the running is the beauty of the whole story. How running turns out to be like a spiritual advocate for you, you know? So during that period of time in Malo, when I was playing, I didn't have mentors that were spiritual leaders that could guide an 18-year-old through all of this fame and fortune. Through all of this, you know, this money and adulation and being on television and being on the radio and seeing your poster of your record at Tower of Records, you know, and it's just a lot to take in. And without somebody guiding you through those experiences, you can have the tendency to connect with the wrong people, start making wrong choices, which will derail you from the path that you've been set upon. I feel that life set me on this extraordinary gift of music. And you know, when I first started to take off with the gift, I really was trying to be positive and to be grateful for the opportunity that was given to me, playing at all these great places, playing with these great musicians. And, you know, so along that journey, you know, all of the other excesses that are available to you, like alcohol, drugs, relationships with different people, and which in the beginning, when you think that that's all good and all cool, you know, there are some people that can survive that. You know, they go through a lot of turmoil in their journey because, you know, maybe they're still young and they got a lot of oats to sow still. So they begin to, you know, really go off the rails. And those, some of those people survive. They can wake up one morning and say, "Man, you know, I'm good with it. You know, I don't want to do that anymore. You know, I'm going to get married. I'm going to have kids. You know, I'm going to put this money in the bank. I'm going to buy a house and I'm going to put my kids in college." There are those very select group that can do that. Unfortunately, I was of the group that I got consumed with the excesses of the limelight, you know, the ability to smoke a little more weed, you know, snort a little bit more cocaine, drink a little bit more scotch, and couldn't put all those things in the right cupboards, you know. So eventually those became excesses. And unfortunately, they started to consume my thinking. I started to become, instead of being obsessed and compelled to practice the drums and to play music and to surround myself with people that would help me to be a better musician and set me on a course. So by the time I, you know, was into the music for a couple of years, that obsession, that compulsion started to become negative. And I found myself becoming consumed and obsessed with wanting to drink more, wanting to, you know, party more. And before I knew it, that became the most important thing. And then that is what caused me to leave the band, because I was so insecure about my behavior that I tried to find some redemption. And that scared me into going to another extreme route. And then I got involved in religion, and I got involved in this situation with this group that ended up, as far as I'm concerned, became a cult. You know, because it was a very close-minded, fanatic, indoctrinated Bible teaching organization, that it was, you know, very, you know, end time apocalyptic thinking and preparing. I hung in that for 10 years. And in that period of time, I was, as they say, in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, white knuckling it. You know, you're just like, you're keeping yourself from doing it. You still have that obsession with it, but you managed to have a little bit of strength to fight it off. And all of a sudden I found myself in this place and I wasn't happy there. And then eventually that turned sour. You know, we were preparing for the end times and, you know, moving up into the mountains and preparing food and this, that, and the other. And before I knew it, I was like completely disillusioned and left that all behind, came back into trying to live a normal life, get a normal job. But the music was always resounding in the back of my mind, because that's what my true love was, my first true love, right? So when I came back into the scene, I had been out of it for 10 years, and I tried to get back into where I had left off, and it was just impossible, because everybody in 10 years, a new generation of musicians had grown, and they had gone to college, they had gone their degrees, they had got their PhDs, they were in the recording studios, they were traveling the world, and I was this guy who had left the music scene, tried to get back into it, and all the doors were closed. You know, everybody had graduated into, you know, the college realm, and I felt like I was still in elementary school, you know. So I tried to get an edge on it, and I went back to those ideas that I thought were helpful, which was negative behavior, which is, you know, went to the old places, hooked up with the old friends, and got back to the old behaviors. And before I knew it, I was full-fledged back into doing drugs again. And that lasted for over 20 years. And it escalated from, you know, smoking weed to hanging out with people that I knew had cocaine. So then I was doing that. And before I knew it, I was completely crushed, got divorced. My family moved. I was all alone. And you went into relationships that weren't working. And finally, you know, thank God I found the right person. And, you know, just to say, we've been together now for over 34 years. But that journey until the running became something paramount in my life. There was a lot of sadness, a lot of despair, because that dream that I had brewing in my heart was crushed by all of my decisions in life that I had made.
Let's talk about running. Let's talk about how'd you get into running?
I got into recovery. I ended up at Skyline College. And in that place, because I had had a great experience prior to that running the Beta Breakers. So I remembered that running was very fulfilling and that I really had a sense of accomplishment just for 7.5 miles.
When did you run the Beta Breakers?
I would say maybe the first time I did it was maybe 1990. Yeah, around 1990, exactly, somewhere around there. I ran that one race and then I didn't run again until about 2005. But what happens is I went to Skyline College. I met a gentleman, the teacher, and we signed up for the class because I remembered that I really enjoyed running. So by this time, I'm in recovery and I'm clean and sober and my mind is clear and I have set goals. So he told me that the class wasn't big enough, so we had to cancel the class, but we're going to do weight training, but you can still go out and run. So I did that, I followed his suggestion, and then I went online and I signed up for the next Beta Breakers. And I ran that. After that, it was such a great experience. All the people, you know, sober and feeling like, wow, this is amazing. You know, the starting line and running and just, you know, being competitive with people that are out there and you're trying to, you know, do your best and you got this attitude of not giving up and running your best. So after that was over, I went home and I told my wife, I said, hey, I want to do another race. I said, I heard of this thing called a marathon. I'd like to try it. And she goes, well, do you know how many miles that is? I said, no. I said, I could do it. She goes, well, it's 26.2 miles. I said, she goes, that's what a marathon is. She goes, you just ran 7.5 miles. I said, but I can do it. I think I can do it. She goes, don't you want to do like a half first? I said, no, because when I'm finished, there'll still be people running and I'll feel like I'm losing out somehow. So crazy, I signed up for the San Francisco Marathon and I trained, I think, for like maybe 8 weeks. You know, I knew nothing about it. I didn't know any runners. I just put on my shoes. I lived in Pacifica and I just started running around Pacifica. You know, and I thought it was a big deal that I ran 3 miles, you know, 4 miles and 5 miles. And I tried to increase the mileage. And eventually, you know, I ran the San Francisco Marathon and I did it in my first attempt. I did it in 4 hours and 25 minutes.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Why don't we back up a little bit? Because I think we glossed over the whole subject of you getting clean. And that whole process, you know, you found your old friends, you went back to an old place, you did the Beta Breakers, I'm assuming somewhere in that period of time.
So what happened was I was using so much that I just was starting to feel out of control. So, you know, I thought I could do it on my own. So I stopped, you know, I stopped hanging out, I stopped going places and I started to try to get healthy. And then I read somewhere that there's this race coming to San Francisco and they have it every year. And I had seen it when I worked at the hotel. You know, that the Beta Breakers was coming. So I decided to do it. So I signed up for it and I started training around South City running. And, you know, it was a short distance. So I really felt empowered by it. The preparation for it and then showing up at the race was just an incredible sense of community. And I felt like I was really involved with something that was super powerful and positive. Everybody was friendly. Everybody seemed, you know, like we had one goal in mind is to run this race. And then I read up on it. So I ran the race. During the race, as I was coming to the finish line, I made a reservation in my mind that I was going to celebrate this accomplishment. And what I did, instead of going and doing something healthy, I went and celebrated by visiting the drug dealer. You know, and I thought that I could go there and celebrate, you know, just one night of celebrating. But as they say, I was the first to get to the party and the last one to leave. While that was a wonderful experience that seared in my heart as something powerful to do, the waking up the gorilla in the cage again by going and starting up with the drugs again consumed me. And from after running the Beta Breakers on Saturday or on Sunday, that night I went and celebrated by consuming drugs again. And that stayed with me for over 20 years. That's how powerful the power of addiction is. Once you open the door to it, again, once you've closed it, or you think you've closed it, unless you have the proper experience, it's hard to shake it off. So that lasted for 20 years until I ended up in recovery at a facility in Oakland, and they helped me. But when I left there, I relapsed. And during that time of relapse, my mother passed away. I was at the crossroad. All the tools that I had learned at the recovery facility, I put it in my spiritual tool bag and was encouraged to always know that that was there, even if I relapsed and found myself in a dark place. So after my mom passed away and I went back to work, I found myself there in that dark place. And I utilized the tools that they gave me, spiritual tools of how to ask for help spiritually first. So that's what I did. And I reached out to my higher power and I asked them to, you know, to relieve me of this obsession and compulsion to use. And that's what I did. And from that day forward, it's been, that was December 8th. And it's been 16 years that I've been clean and sober and free from all substance. Very proud of that accomplishment, 16 years of it. And in that process of being, you know, of going to meetings, people would tell me, you'll find out what you're going to do next. Just keep coming to the meetings. You know, don't use in between. Sit in the front row, wait for the miracles to happen. And that's what happened. I went to a meeting and a woman shared her extraordinary experience down the through the life of addiction. And then she said how she went back to school because of the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous and the support that she received. That is the message that I received. And from there, I decided to go back to college. And I went to Skyline College. That's where I met Sonny Diaz, who was the teacher for track and field. And he's the one that said, even if we don't have a running class, because I want you to run, you go out to that track and you run all you want. He said, just sign in, do a little bit of the cardio, go outside. And then from there, the running, I started feeling empowered, like I could do this. You know, running was something that felt innate in me, that it was this little DNA that needed to be turned on, you know, that it was there, but I didn't know it, you know, because I enjoyed running in high school. I never ran on the track team because we were all playing music. But I remember getting on the track and running around it and feeling like, ah, man, this is cool. You know, I like this, you know. So I had running experiences throughout my life. And then that Beta Breakers that I ran and then relapsed for 20 years. The power of running, the power of that experience seared in my brain and in my heart. So one of the first things that I went to when I got sober and clean is I said, I want to run again. I want to run again, even if it's just like a college, you know, join the team there. And before you know it, running became a saving grace for me because all of a sudden I was involved with running groups. The DSE was Dolphin South End Running Group that's been around since 1964 in San Francisco. And then somebody there told me about Brazen Racing, which was trail running, you know, 5K, 10K, half marathons. And all of a sudden, all of these things that were just all this positive reinforcement and empowerment were being like a gift. Like you can run with the DSC, you can run with Brazen Racing, you know, the Boston Marathon. I was like, oh my God, this is great. I substituted addictive behavior and negative behavior for positive behavior. And I don't like to, people say, oh, you're addicted to running now. I said, no, you know, I don't like to use that word addicted. It's kind of like a negative connotation. You know, I substituted bad behavior for good behavior. You know, I've been running now for 16 years. I've done over 50 marathons. I've done probably in the excess of over 100 half marathons. I've run the San Francisco Marathon 13 times. I've run the Boston Marathon 4 times. I've run ultra marathons, 12-hour endurance running. You know, I became a coach. So running has been like my best pal.
If you like our podcast, then sign up for our newsletter where we give you weekly tips on how to run your best race and have fun in the process. Just go to racemob.com and sign up today.
Let me interject here. Our listeners don't know that I've known you for 24 years. We are all in life or we're on our own race. And sometimes on the course, our paths cross. Our paths cross in 95, 96. And I knew you as a kind individual. We worked together in the hotel business in San Francisco, but I knew that you were in pain. And at the time, I thought it was just physical pain because you were having some significant back issues and in some cases were taking you out of work for extended periods of time. As life went on, I eventually left that hotel and stayed in the business. We stayed in contact, but more just in passing. We had common friends, relatives that we both know. But years later, much like I met Kevin through my love of running, our paths crossed again on a race course of all places.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
I knew the face, but the person at his core had changed. There had been a metamorphosis, an emotional and physical metamorphosis. And then to learn your story, because at the time when I knew you back in the 90s, I didn't know you were an accomplished musician. I learned that later in life. But our common love for running and how it's afforded you so many new experiences and a greater circle of positivity, and then the impact that you have had on the community from a running perspective is profound. An ambassador of the sport, both you and Virginia, loved by so many, and your accomplishments as a very young and thriving 60 plus year old individual, a gentleman who on the San Jose Rock and Roll Half Marathon in the, 2013, 14, thereabouts, you're outrunning Roger Craig, a Super Bowl winning Pro Bowl running back for the 49ers, who should be in the Hall of Fame, I might add.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look at this dude. I mean, fantastic. And again, the parallels of our the journey of life, the race that we're all on, there are parts, even in actual races, when you just can, if you can just stop and be present and realize that somebody else has their own story, their own journey. It may not be going to Boston, but it may be just getting to that finish line and the adversity they've had to navigate through to get to that point. We can all relate to a certain degree. So I just wanted to share that I've had a firsthand seat at parts of your journey of life, and it's just simply remarkable to where you are at right now.
Thank you for those kind words. I love you and I cherish our relationship, and I appreciate your kindness. Running is a spiritual experience. You know, I've learned in the program, you teach by example. You know, you can't become a, sergeant at arms, and try to get everybody to, do things that you think is better. Whatever it is that you think is better, you live it, and you live that way so that they could see you. And when there's consistency, and then that changes the perspective of what others have. You know, like now I have my daughters are like, finally, Dad, you got us running. We've been trying for 15 years to get them to run. And I said, don't worry, one day they'll come around. And all of a sudden it's like, my daughter's signing up for the chocolate run and hugging her and saying, look who's here. She's running with us now. We've been trying for years to get them to run. And they see, how that's changed our lives and the positivity that it's brought. You know, that's why I'm grateful every day to have legs, to have arms, to be able to go. Even I've torn my plantars. I've popped my plantars. I had back surgery, osteoarthritis in one hip. But man, if I can, I'll still go out there and I'll try. You know, I may not be able to go as far, but I'll stop, regroup, and keep on moving. I figure if I could overcome 16 years of substance abuse, because I was very, very sick. Running, is just like, it's life. You know, you start out at the starting gate, and there's many times along that race where you just want to call it a day. You know, like when we did that Santa Rosa, you and me, that was tough, dude.
Woo, 2018.
Oh, my God.
I thought we were running in hell for a moment. Granted, it was the wine country, but it was hot as you know what, burning up.
I catch Bertrand, I catch him. And we'd be together for a little bit, and then I'd just like fall, and then he would just take off, and I'd see him in the distance. Later on, I'd catch up to him again, and I'd leave him, and I'd go in the distance, and it was just like that, cat and mouse the whole way. I mean, I would have finished the race regardless, but I think because of his tenacity and his just like running like a soldier, man, he was just like boom, 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 and I just would draft behind him and just try to stay in that space that he was in. He was like a mentor out on the course, like, don't give up, dude, you could do this. You know, I mean, that's what running is. There's so much that goes on, so much mental chatter in your head that is like, oh, I'm so tired, I want to quit. And then you have those little moments where the chemicals, the dopamines, the serotonins, all are pouring in and in your back. It's an amazing, amazing sport. I've met so many tremendous people along the way. And, running the Boston Marathon, running the San Francisco Marathon.
Let's not gloss over the Boston Marathon. I mean, you're wearing that jacket right now, that 2020 Boston Marathon jacket.
Yeah, Leo's not getting out there just participating. to be clear, everybody, listeners, he's out there with a purpose. Yes, he's a man in the community, an artist at heart, but he is a savage on the course. He is looking to run you down. And as much as he says we're playing cat and mouse, usually I was all the time chasing him down. And I could not. Routinely, brazen races, multiple age group winner, placing on a consistent basis, multiple time Boston Marathon participant. I remember seeing your journey via social media when you very first qualified for Boston. So take us back to chasing down that dream and then being in Boston,
briefly, you know, after being in the running circle, you start hearing about all these tremendous races around the world, the Big Six, you know, the Boston, the San Francisco, and this and that. So I heard, if you want to do Boston, you have to qualify for it. So a couple of years into running, I made the attempts and I would just, you know, I'd fall short by 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, had to make a bathroom stop and that killed the time. And so, but somebody said, just keep trying. You'll get there. You'll get there. And then finally someone, when I was 59 years old, said, if you can beat 3:55 and be 60 years old on race day, you can do it at 59. You understand what I mean? The qualifying time for 60 to 64 year olds is 3 hours and 55 minutes. You can qualify for that time being 59 if you are 60 on race day. So I said, okay, so that gives me another 5 minutes on the clock. So Brazen Racing has a race called Western Pacific. It's totally flat. It's in Fremont.
Quarry Lakes.
It's got gravel, asphalt for 26.2 miles. It's not running in the street. A little easier on your legs, but still it's a little harder because you have all that loose gravel on the road. So I ran that race with my heart in mind that I wanted to qualify for Boston because it was a Boston qualifier. So I got in front of the 3:55 finisher, no, in the middle of the 3:50 and the 3:55 pacer. And I set myself in between them. I ran the race like that. And when we got to the turnaround, I was feeling strong and I was maintaining that position. Then when we went out all the way to like mile, I think it was like mile 20, 23, 24, where there was a turnaround, the 3:50 pacer was right on my tail. And he had seen that I was, you know, keeping that pace. So when I made the turn and I was heading back to the finish line with 3 miles to go, he passed me and he says, I'm catching up on you. He says, you better step on it. He goes, because when we make this turn, we're going to be right on your tail. So that pushed me. And I remember thinking, I was already packing my bags to go to Boston in my mind, you know? Mm-hmm. And I said, no, don't go there. And I started to get emotional. I started to feel this emotion, wanting to cry out of, you know, out of joy. And I said, calm down, dude. I said, keep it calm. Cry when you cross that finish line. Keep it together. You got another 3.5 miles. And after doing 23 miles, 3 miles seems like, oh my God, legs are burning, lungs are burning. It's hot outside. So I just stay focused. So I went on. He was behind me and I could hear them. I could hear their footsteps. So I was just like, you know, giving it all that I got. And then when I saw the finish line, you know, I stepped on it and I crossed the finish line with a 3:53. So I managed to qualify for Boston there. And I was like beside myself, man. I couldn't believe it that I accomplished that.
Which year was this?
This was in 2013 because I qualified for the 2014 Boston Marathon. As soon as I told my wife, she's on the phone making reservations at the hotel. And I said, wait a minute, they haven't approved of it yet. She goes, yeah, but they're going to. So, you know, airplane and, you know, hotel. And then I sent the time in and then I got the qualification saying you've been accepted into the 2014, you know, Boston Marathon. So that was a big deal.
And this is basically 10 years into getting into running. It's the hard work. It's the perseverance over those 10 years. Tell us, what was your time when you first got into running? How did that time change? And what were those emotions?
I was doing a lot of running. I was running with DSC. So that those were 5Ks, basically, sometimes 10Ks. Once every 6 months, they would do a half marathon at Lake Merced. But the meat of DSC was 5Ks, fast 5Ks every Sunday. 52 weeks of the year minus the Beta Breakers, the San Francisco Marathon, the Bridge to Bridge, you know, but so 48 weeks of the year was DSC running. Every Sunday you show up and there was always competitive. You're always, because, you know, you try to sneak up and I used to sneak up to the front of the line and then these guys would take off and I'd be like, woo, up in the back. So every Sunday was speed work. And then with DSC, I mean, with Brazen Racing, that was trail running. So this is going up and going down and going across and over the water and over the bridge and, you know, 13 miles of hardcore running. And this was a little more exciting because it was age group here. You know, so if you were, you know, 60 to 64, that was your race with those other competitors. You know, the women had their side and the men had theirs. So when I started, you know, first place, second place, age group, that motivated me that every time I ran, I had that competitive spirit in me, you know, a healthy competitiveness to try to, you know, always get in first place. So that running took place. And then Virginia got us involved with Coastal Trail Running. And this was like, you know, 50 Ks, you know, running 30 miles. So we started doing that. So all of a sudden, you know, we're running Thursday, we're running Friday, we're doing races on Saturday, we're doing DSE on Sunday. So the more I ran, the more I started to pick up speed. So my best marathon time was California International Marathon, CIM. And I did that one in my best time, 3 hours, 45 minutes and 10 seconds. And that was the perfect day of running. And I would go to the track and do speed work, you know, intervals, you know, fartleks, you know, 800 meter splits. And I would work with Andy Chan, who is the track and field coach at Sacred Heart in San Francisco. And he's trained Olympians. He's trained qualifiers to go to the Olympics. So he's a great motivator and a great trainer. And we would meet at Kezar Stadium and do, you know, 600-800 meter splits, you know, and I saw that by doing those splits, those 800 meters, that my time just started getting faster and faster. And there was, you know, there's been experiences running where I felt like I was flying. This is just incredible feeling, you know, and it's not there all the time. Most of the time it's work. That's how at that time where there was a lot of running going on and that served as good training for picking up speed.
So 10 years of running and finally Boston qualifying. What was that Boston experience like?
Ordering the jacket and then having the jacket and then getting on the airplane wearing a Boston Marathon jacket. People, oh, you're going to the Boston Marathon race? Yeah, I'm going to run. People like noticing, oh, you're a Boston runner? And yeah, this is my first time. Oh, cool, man, right on, you know? So, and then getting to Boston and saying, man, I made it. Start thinking of all the adversities that you've overcome and to find yourself at the Grand Prix of running, the Super Bowl of running, to walk down the street and everybody's wearing a jacket and everybody's training and running. And you're like, wow, man, this is a big deal that I'm here, you know? And then, you know, get to the expo, this mega expo. Oh my God. It's just like this enormous building consumed with running. Every company that sells shoes, every company that sells jackets, every company that sells goo gels and sports drinks and this and that, and this can make you a better runner. This can make you a handsome runner. This can make you this runner. And then meeting the Kenyan runners, these like shaking hands with these runners that can do the marathon in like 2 hours and 15 minutes. You know what I mean? All of that. And then the dinner before the race, walking down the street where the race is taking place and seeing the finish sign on the ground and, you know, Boylston Avenue and Boston Commons and just like this energy in the air. Was wonderful. And then the bombing had taken place the year before, 2013. So there was that air of community and the air of love and spiritual, you know, healing. And there, women from around the country had knitted scarves for all of the Boston runners that were going to be running. So you walk down the street and there would be a lady there with a hand or an arm filled with beautiful hand knitted scarves. And she'd say, are you running the Boston Marathon? And you say, yes. She goes, well, this is for you. And she'd give it to me, and there would be the signature of the ladies that, you know, we're from Kentucky, and we made this for you for good luck at the run, you know, peace and blah, blah, blah. It was like, and then we went to one of the churches on Sunday morning, and the pastor of the church had all the runners stand up and said this beautiful prayer, blessing all the runners from around the world. And I was like, wow, man, this is just incredible. Because I'd reflect, like, look where I was years ago, and look where I am now. Because life gave me a second chance and I grabbed a hold of it, right? So when I went on race day, first of all, on Saturday, you have a fun 5K that you do. So Virginia and I have done the 5K, you know, 14, 15, 16, and 19 together. And 10,000 runners come out for that. And it's really exciting, you know, and I run with her and we have a wonderful experience. You know, you get shirts and medals, and then you go to the expo and you walk up Boylston Avenue and all the hoopla that's going on. And then on race day, that was like, oh my, I had all my clothes laid out, you know, taking pictures of it, you know, FaceTiming and all this and that. And then when I got there, you know, when we get to the arch that says, welcome to Hopkinton to the 2014 Boston Marathon, and there's jets flying over, and because this is after the bombing. So you have army standing there with their weapons along the line. There's helicopters flying over, there's snipers on roofs, and it's like, you know, but they're all really kind, you know, the police, the special forces, everybody that was there to protect the runners were very compassionate and very loving and very kind to all the runners. I took a picture with 12 policemen. I asked the one guy, can I take a picture with you guys? He goes, well, you can ask them. I'll be glad to. So I said, hey, fellas, you know, you guys might. And these guys are like, you know, 6 foot tall and I'm like 5 foot two. And I got a great picture of me standing with the Boston Police Department, you know. So standing at the archway of the race reminded me of the archway that I stood at when I first went into recovery. When I first went into recovery, it was like Newbridge. And it was owned by William Randolph Hearst, the owner of the Chronicle. This was one of his mansions. And he donated the mansion to the city, who turned it into a recovery facility. So that's where I was. And there was the arch that said, you know, Newbridge, you know, new life, new start. And I'm like, you know, had a drink in maybe 20 hours or something. And then feeling of despair and of sadness that I had let not only myself down, but my family, my kids. And then years later, after turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood it, there I was standing at the archway of the 2014 Boston Marathon. And I was like, man, miracles do happen. Look where I am. I'm turning around. There's 30,000 runners. There's all of this excitement. And I'm fortunate enough to be standing there with all of those runners. And then when the guy says, all right, you know, here we go, boom, ready, you know, 3, 2, 1. And we were on and we were going. It was like, wow, this is a dream. I'm dreaming right here. And seeing the finish line coming up the street. And then I forget the name of that street, but there's a left turn onto Boylston and you can see the finish line in the distance and it looks really tiny. And I just remember like, all, and the cheering, the people cheering and high-fiving and, you know, it's like, wow, this is really living right here. And each experience through the Boston Marathon was just like that. You're running down and people are high-fiving you. You stop and you high-five a little kid and you can see their excitement, like, you know, like some great, you know, Greek athlete just shook my hand, you know. It's a pretty life-changing experience. And then to cross that finish line and get that Boston medal, you're like, oh my God. You know, you just want to get on your knees and say, thank you for giving me a second chance. You know, and running has been a tremendous part of our recovery. You know, every time we go to a different town, we look up where the meetings are. You know, go to New York, go to the meetings to always remember the newcomer, that poor soul who is fresh in recovery and maybe hasn't done drugs in one day and he's hurting spiritually, mentally, and physically. So you go to give support. The runners, you know, I've never met a runner that's been mean to me. You know, he'll say, how you doing? You know, you'll run by me. He's like, feeling, oh man, falling apart. He goes, oh, you can do it. Come on, you know, hit that aid station, get some water in you. He's about finishing, you know, you can do it. Come on now, you know, stick with me. Dean Karnazes doing the Napa Marathon, trying to qualify for Boston on that one. And he was there and he's running. And he comes up next to me and I'm, oh, Dean, man, how are you doing? He goes, how are you doing? I said, okay. He goes, I said, I'm trying to qualify for the Boston Marathon. He goes, you could do it. Just keep it up. Keep it up. Don't worry about it. You got this. So, and then he disappeared. And then I was running. And then I started falling apart around mile 18. And there he comes again. He goes, how you doing? I said, I don't know, man. I don't know if I can get this done. He says, it's okay. He says, there's always other times. He says, but don't quit. Just keep it going. Get to that finish line. Just try your best. Give it the best that you got. That's all you got. Don't worry about it. And then he took off again. So he was like a little guardian angel, man. Two or three times he came up on me to check up on me. And I saw that he was doing that throughout the race. He was going up to people and seeing how they were doing. It's been an incredible journey running. You know, I took this time that we've had to be in sheltering in place and have put up all our medals, you know, strategically, our shadow boxes and thousands of medals on the wall. And we walk down the hall and I'll turn around and stop and look at it. And I'll say, damn, look at all those medals, man. And so Virginia and I estimated that we've probably done over 17,000 miles in our 16 years of running.
Wow.
So running for me is a gift from heaven, you know, from the universe, this ability to move my legs one in front of the other, one day at a time, one step at a time. You know, the finish line is there. If you keep moving, if you stop, the finish line is not there. You can't walk off the course and call a cab. You got to get it done. Even if they close everything down, you got to cross it regardless, you know, but don't quit. And I safe to say that I've never DNF. Not that if that happens, that there's something wrong with that, because there isn't. Because if you DNF, it's because something came up that you just couldn't deal with. But I've tried to avoid that situation by you know, preparing properly for a race and doing what needs to be done to get to finish the race.
So profound.
Thank you.
So many life parallels, you know, one foot in front of the other. We're all going to deal with our fair share of adversity. Sometimes it's going to come at the most inopportune time. We are all living in the pandemic right now and are dealing with varying levels of anxiety and wondering, will we ever be able to get out and about like we have before in the past? And maybe not live racing, but we can still get out and enjoy a good run, take in our beautiful area, and just appreciate the ability to take in a full breath in and exhale out, where so many people who have been close to us might not have that opportunity and just have a greater appreciation for where we're at right now. And keep on pushing.
With the fires in California, thank God I got a treadmill so I can run on that. You know, it gets a little stuffy because they don't have fresh oxygen, but it's just the point of that movement. And now if I don't run and I don't move, it starts affecting my head, start feeling like something's wrong. You know, and then I talk to other runners and it seems like, yeah, I get that too. So, okay, I'm not alone then. No, not at all.
In fact, don't you have a race coming up in the next week or so?
Yes, I do.
Why don't we talk about that real quick? I know we want to respect your time, but let's share about that race you have on the calendar.
Well, luckily that one, it's the Boston Marathon virtual race, and they're giving you 6 hours to get it done. It's not a qualifier, but if you get it done at your own pace within 6 hours, you get your medal, you get a shirt, and you get your certificate, you know, and you get a bib and just the regular stuff you would get at if you went to Boston. But unfortunately, I haven't been able to train as much as I would like. But speaking with Virginia, she goes, look, you got 6 hours. You can get it done. You know, just find a nice pace and I'll support you on the bike. You know, I'll create a little aid station for you and, you know, just go do it. And I said, okay, you're the boss. The trainer says, go and do it. I got to do it. Yeah. So that's coming up and I'm excited about it.
And give our listeners, again, an idea on where they can listen to some of your musical accomplishments. We know the pandemic has curtailed your touring, but how else can people, you know, find out your musical prowess?
If you want to hear Mallow music, you can go to iTunes and press Mallow, and you'll see the albums of the band, and you can listen to them through iTunes, or you can go to YouTube and put Mallow and click on different songs, and some people may, you know, the older generation are probably more familiar with it. And if the older generation played a lot of our music when their kids were little, the younger generation will probably remember some of these tunes as well. So that's if you want to hear Mallow. My group, it's called Momotombo, and that's Momotombo, MomotomboSF.com. That's our website. And you can click on that and watch some performances, little snapshots of some of the gigs that we've been doing. And you can see, you know, our gallery and see what we all look like, you know, older generation of players, but we still kill it whenever we go out and play. You know, we may be 66 and 65, but we rock and roll.
Still bad, but bad in a good way, right?
Yeah, and we're blessed with tremendous players from the Bay Area. When we count off that tune, you better look out because the volcanoes are going to explode on you. That's what Momotombo is. It's a volcano in Nicaragua. So that's why we named it that. So we got music, we got running, we got kids, we got grandkids. You know, what more can a person ask for? And good behavior, 16 years of sobriety.
Fantastic, man, one day at a time.
So there you have it.
Thank you so much for being on our podcast, Leo. I mean, the story is incredible, but the person is even more so. And
thank you.
Thank you so much for the time. Can't wait to see you out on the trails.
Yeah.
When live racing is back on, I'm sure we will see you out on Brazen Trails and other races. And so fantastic. So thank you so much.
And I wish you guys all the success in the world. And I know that you will be successful in your lives and what you're doing for the community and sending blessings out to your families, your mothers, your fathers, sisters, brothers, that they all be blessed and they all be protected at this, you know, perilous times that we're faced with. But you know what? Love conquers all. You know, just as powerful as hatred and violence is a powerful force, love, kindness, compassion, tenderness, meekness, forgiveness is just as powerful or more powerful. So that's what we have to focus on, is to send thoughts of love out to the world so that, because love will overcome, it'll overcome and things will get back. Because I know we all have kids and grandkids and we want the best for them. So God bless you guys and we'll see each other soon.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leo.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Race Mob Podcast. Check out all of the show notes or find a running buddy online at racemob.com. Please subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, and leave us a review. Until next time, keep on moving.